Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
It's our 10 best books of 2020. This week's episode was recorded on November 23rd via Zoom in front of a live audience online. Please forgive some hiccups in sound quality and the longer length. We hope the books and conversations are worth it. Joining me in this episode are a number of my fellow editors at The Book Review, Tina Jordan, Greg Coles, MJ Franklin, Gal Beckerman, Lauren Christensen, Emily Aiken, Dave Kim, and Elizabeth Egan, as well as my podcast comrade-in-arms, John Williams. Good morning, everyone. I'm Pamela Paul, editor of the New York Times Book Review. Welcome to the best books of 2020. We're so happy to have all of you here with us today. We're thrilled to have so many people join us from so many places. This is the benefit of doing this here in Zoom as opposed to in the Times Center in New York City. We have Times subscribers joining us this morning from every single state, plus more than 50 countries, including Argentina, New Zealand, and Denmark. And before I start, a big thank you. Your subscriptions to the Times are what allow us and our colleagues to do our work. Choosing the 10 best books of the year is a year-long process. And believe it or not, we've already started on 2021. Your subscriptions help make this work possible, and we thank you for that. Speaking of my team at The Book Review, I'd like to welcome some of my colleagues on the desk who are joining with me today. Dave Kim, MJ Franklin, Lauren Christensen, Emily Aiken, John Williams, Elizabeth Egan, Gal Beckerman, Tina Jordan, and Greg Coles. Before we get into the list, I'm going to talk very briefly about what we mean by a best book and how we go about choosing them. For us, a best book is a book that stands on the merits of its prose and its storytelling and succeeds on the terms that the author sets out for it. It's a book that might be of the moment, but it's a book that we also think transcends the moment and will stand the test of time. We don't choose these books because we necessarily agree with them, support a political or ideological message forwarded by them, or personally like the authors. We don't choose books merely because we consider them important or worthy. The best books have to succeed in all ways, on all levels. We choose these books because we think these books offer a level of achievement that readers have come to expect from the New York Times. It's impossible to fully convey what it takes to get there, but let me say this. When I call this a year-long process, I mean it. We start this list as soon as we finish the last one, and yes, as I said, we've begun on 2021. The bulk of the work is reading. I know it doesn't seem like real work, but we are deep reading and reading repeatedly. And of course, after that comes deep discussion in which editors at The Book Review, many of whom are here today, talk about these books with one another and no holds barred. We discuss, we debate, we strongly and freely disagree with one another, but we listen to each other's arguments and we continue to read ourselves with an open mind. And ultimately, after months of deliberation, we have a vote. Sometimes, as in real life, there'll be a runoff, but we ultimately come to a list of the 10 best books that we all feel excited and proud of. So without further ado, let's get into it. I'm going to start with fiction. And first up on the fiction list, we have A Children's Bible by Lydia Millett. My colleague Emily Aiken is going to start us off talking about that novel.
Good morning. First, a couple words about Lydia Millett. She is a veteran novelist, the author of perhaps a dozen books, several of them prize winning, though I think it's fair to say she's known by that ambiguous moniker, writer's writer. And I'm hopeful that with A Children's Bible, she will find the larger audience I think she deserves. Another Important fact about Lydia Millett is that she has a day job. She has a degree in environmental policy and works at an environmental nonprofit in Arizona where she lives. And as we'll see, that's a fact is relevant to a children's Bible. So let's talk about the book. It has a deceptively simple allure. It's got that cover sort of children's nursery rhyme style with the little baby animals trotting across it. It's written in a very understated and playful way. It's filled with short, sharp dialogue, a lot of it among teenagers. Yet there's a lot more going on here than meets the eye. When I first read the book, I told my colleagues, think of it as The Big Chill meets Apocalypse Now. And I think that got them interested in the book. It turns out that's a pretty inexact analogy, but let's run with it a little bit today. So the big chill part, the book opens with a reunion of college friends, now middle-aged, who've rented a big house in the country for the summer with their kids. They convene there and immediately they regress. They start boozing, popping ecstasy, bed hopping, and their kids, who range in age from elementary school to high school, watch this spectacle with mounting disgust. So, and the book is narrated by one of the kids, a precocious, wry teenager named Evie. And the first section of the book is really a kind of generational comedy done with a very light touch. But then the gears shift, a storm arrives. It's no ordinary storm. And suddenly things take a very dark and sinister turn. And this is the Apocalypse Now part of the book. Yes, there are some deranged men with guns who show up. The apocalypse here is really climate apocalypse. And the grownups can't cope. There's total social breakdown, infrastructure collapse, and the kids have to take charge. So among other things, a children's Bible is an indictment of a generation's failure to deal with climate change. And one last thing I want to say about this very remarkable book is that it's populated with allusions to the Bible. You might not notice them. They're very cleverly interpolated into the plot, but they come with increasing frequency as the story progresses. There's a Moses figure floating on a blow-up raft in the reeds. There's a Noah's Ark scene as animals are rescued from the floodwaters. There are three wise men in the form of hikers off the Appalachian Trail who arrive in time to witness the birth of a baby in a barn in a manger. There's even a crucifixion. And I'll leave it to you, Millett's readers, to decide what she's up to here, but she's not a religious writer or a sacrilegious writer, but with elegant subtlety and, again, an unfailingly light touch, she seems to be suggesting that our most ancient stories have a profound contemporary resonance, and the result is a book that's funny and timely and deep. And I know MJ, my colleague, has some other thoughts about it. MJ?
Yeah, that was so beautifully said. And one of the things that you mentioned that I think hits the nail on the head is that there's more than meets the eye in this book. I have a copy here. It is a pretty slim book for how densely packed with metaphor and resonance it is. There are two things I wanted to point out with this book, which is one, it starts off so funny and becomes horrifying in what's happening in this world and what these kids are having to face. And the thing that I really gravitated toward while reading was it really taps into this kind of like generational anger that I think a lot of young people feel about climate change, if adults had stuff that they were able to do and they didn't. And I think this book like literalizes that, and you see how these kids at first are angry at the adults in the book, and then they kind of do that horrible just disappointed kind of thing where they say like, we will take care of ourselves. And it's such a fascinating journey to go on. But then the other thing I wanted to say is when you have a book titled The Children's Bible, you start looking for all of the biblical metaphors and the biblical allusions, and they're certainly there. But what really impressed me with this book is that you get the sense that the biblical metaphors aren't there just to do a one-to-one relationship, but really to kind of take the story and boost it up into this realm with gravitas on the same level of some of our most sacred stories of how do we cope with climate change? How does one generation kind of grapple with the failures of another? And it's really remarkable. And considering how slim this book is, it's so fantastically, incredibly crafted. I highly encourage you to check it out. It's well deserving of a place on this list.
All right, MJ, Emily, thank you so much. We're going on to our second title on the fiction side. It is Homeland Elegies by Ayad Akhtar. John, tell us about this book.
Thanks, Pamela. I only have a couple of minutes to talk about a book that is not interested in being reduced. And actually, I think that's one of its greatest strengths. So it's kind of interesting, but I'm so happy to talk about it because I found it to be maybe the most interesting novel of this year for me. To really boil it down, as our reviewer Hari Kunzru wrote in the book review, is that this book is a cascade of scenes and stories that vibrate with the stressful contradictions of an American Muslim life. My colleagues and I talked a lot this year about Akhtar's interesting and even provocative decision to call this book a novel, because so much of it really maps very directly with his own life, to the point where calling it an autobiographical novel almost doesn't feel like enough. The narrator of the book, like Akhtar, won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 2013. And that is just one of many very specific details like that that ring true with everyday life. So that's an example of art imitating life. Did Akhtar's father, a doctor, really treat Donald Trump for heart trouble in the 1990s? I don't know, but the novel does open with that riveting story. So we had some good-natured discussions about what this book really is, but we all agreed that it was excellent and that it belonged on this list wherever it's shelved and wherever Akhtar decides it's shelved ultimately. Perhaps not surprisingly, given his renown as a playwright, one of the novel's greatest strengths is its sense of dialogue. And by that, I don't just mean what the characters say to each other, but this is a book that very much, through its narrator's intelligence, puts places, ideas, and people in dialogue with each other. There's a sense, including the narrator himself, and one could say, therefore, Akhtar himself. There are even two homelands in the book's title, Homeland Elegies. There's Pakistan, the country from which Akhtar's parents emigrate to the United States. I should say the narrator's parents, but Akhtar's did too, in the late 1960s. And there is America, the country where Akhtar and the narrator were raised, mostly in the suburbs of Milwaukee. And so through all of this, there are bits that read like memoir, there are parts that read like personal essays, and there are parts that do read, that sort of open out into novelistic scenes. And what Akhtar is really writing about over and over again is what it is to be a Muslim in America, especially after 9/11. And obviously there's a lot of contentiousness involved in that. There's a lot of bigotry involved in that. But many times when you think that Akhtar is making a point for your side, whichever side that might happen to be, he tends to complicate that point in the very next sentence. And the result is not confusion and contradiction, but actually kind of clarity of an increasingly rare kind, which is the clarity of the truth that people are endlessly, fascinatingly, and yes, maddeningly complex. And I suppose that's ultimately what makes the book feel like a novel to me, is its interest in getting fully inside of people, including the author himself, not to fully understand or forgive them necessarily, but to convey them as accurately as possible. And so that, in a nutshell, is a book that certainly isn't made to fit into one. And I know that my colleague Dave wants to talk about it too. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thanks, John. I mean, my favorite parts of this novel are actually the sections that veer away from narrative and into social commentary on just an array of issues. I mean, you'll never have known that you were so interested in Robert Bork and municipal finances and medical malpractice until you read Akhtar just breaking things down and showing you why these things should matter to you. And what impresses me most is, I think, the breadth of his range. You know, books are often marketed by how they help you understand a particular aspect of society or a group, you know, whether it's the American Muslim experience or the crush of debt, or, I mean, Homeland Elegies does these things, but it really helped me understand America better. You know, Akhtar opens with Walt Whitman and Melville and Emerson and this kind of American transcendental myth that I think we're all familiar with. And then he just spends the rest of the book, you know, just dismantling it to pieces. And, you know, you mentioned the Akhtar's father, or the narrator's father, who's this aspirational American who's sort of lured by the pleasures of decadence. And, you know, I was speaking to Pamela about this, about how the father is like a reporter's dream. You know, he's like the lead to your richly reported story about, you know, Trump's appeal among immigrants and people of color, et cetera. But, you know, the characters also are so fully developed and they're rich. They're not just cardboard stand-ins for a social archetype, but they're real human beings. And I love that about this book. And if you're the type of person who really needs a linear narrative and a conventional structure, I urge you to go in with an open mind. It's been a very confusing election year with just a million dynamics at play. this book really helped me make a lot of sense of it.
Thank you, Dave. All right. Third on our list on the fiction side, Deacon King Kong by James McBride. And Dave, why don't you start off again? Tell us about that novel.
Sure. Deacon King Kong begins with an elderly church deacon named Sportcoat shooting a neighborhood drug dealer in the face. And unfortunately for Sportcoat, the drug dealer survives. And so Sportcoat has essentially just signed his own death warrant. It's 1969. We're in a public housing project in a part of Brooklyn that sounds a lot like Red Hook. You know, racial inequality is stark. Poverty is even starker. And yet this was one of the funniest and liveliest books I've read in this very stark year. You know, imagine The Wire, but with a little more church. Imagine like Dickens, but with Sam Cooke and Bachata playing on the soundtrack. Sportcoat is 71. He's drinking himself to death. He's just about the last person anyone would expect to take on a drug dealer. I mean, even he doesn't know why he did it and doesn't remember even doing it. But the shooting sets off this chain reaction and spreads across the neighborhood and sweeps up this huge cast of characters from, you know, church-going old-timers to rival drug dealers to mobsters who run the local docks, detectives, and they all have like really colorful nicknames like Hot Sausage and Beanie and Pudgy Fingers. This isn't a book that distills down easily to a, you know, quick plot summary. And you could criticize the book for all the different subplots and the elaborate riffs and jokes that he's throwing in. And you wouldn't be wrong, but you'd also be like the guy at the concert who's yelling at the band for playing too many solos and not focusing on the song. And I mean, you know, when you're in good hands, like the writer is a master and is clearly having just a great time, it's far more enjoyable to just sit back and enjoy the music. He's also an expert at switching from major to minor keys, from that like just larger than life kind of Coen Brothers humor to really biting social commentary. And it ultimately leaves you in a happy place. I mean, a feeling that despite all of the darkness and despair in the world, good fortune and goodwill can still exist. I think it's just a great book to read if you need a bit of a pick-me-up. And I know Gall had some thoughts too.
Thanks, Dave. Well, I'm mostly just going to offer a great big amen to that. This is just a book written with so much joy. You know, it's clear that, like you said, that he's having such a great time. The word that kept coming back to me over and over again as I was reading it was technicolor, you know, that kind of word we used to use to describe things that were sort of had this brightness, this lushness to them, like almost like a saturation of colors. McBride just loves these characters and he just adores their flaws, their agonies, their desires. And there's something just really wonderful about that sort of, he's almost like not, he's not holding back as a writer. He's just throwing, you know, the kitchen sink of his whole creative imagination into it and letting it just overflow with all of those characters and subplots. Of course, he happens to pull it off, you know, in a lesser writer's hand, it might not have worked. The other thing I wanted to mention is just the way that he plays with genre. You know, there's, you mentioned the shooting and it kind of starts off, you feel like you're going to get a crime story here, but the shooting is really just this sort of pretense to take you into the world of this project that he's created in South Brooklyn and all of the many subplots. And it spirals out in so many directions. I mean, one of my favorite is this story of this kind of older Irish cop who is investigating the shooting that Sportcoat is involved in, and he ends up just falling in love with one of the church ladies who's sort of harboring Sportcoat, and she falls in love with him, and she's Black, and he's this old Irish cop. It's 1969, and McBride just gives us sort of full access to their feelings, to their sort of aching for one another, and it's just, you know, it's sweet and sad and funny and, you know, a lot like the rest of the whole book.
Gall, thank you. All right, we are on number four now. The fourth book on the fiction side is Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell. And to tell us about that, my colleague, Liz Egan.
Hi, thank you all for joining us this morning. Let me set the scene for Hamnet. A plague is sweeping the nation. Ordinary people in small, far-flung towns are reeling from its impact, unsure of who to trust, how to stay safe, and really what to do. This might sound familiar to many of you certainly sounded familiar to me when I picked it up. Welcome to Hamnet, Maggie O'Farrell's eerily, incredibly timely novel about a family hit with unimaginable loss. In their case, the pandemic is the bubonic plague, and the year is 1580-something, and the small town is Stratford-upon-Avon in England. And the family in question here is the Shakespeare family. Yes, those Shakespeares. William, a fledgling playwright, his wife Agnes, who has also been known throughout history as Anne, but is called Agnes in this case, and their three children, their older daughter, Judith, and their twins, Susanna and Hamnet. You might recognize the echo of Hamlet and Hamnet, and apparently back in Shakespeare's time, the two names were somewhat interchangeable. In real life, we know that Hamnet's son died when he was 11, and Maggie O'Farrell imagines that he died of the Black Death. We don't know for sure. And what she spins is a story of a family piecing itself back together around his absence, and a mother turning to nature for solace. Shakespeare's wife was a healer and found peace and comfort in nature. The father, William, whose name is really only mentioned twice in the book, buries himself in work, disappears to London to work on his great masterpiece, which is turning out to be Hamlet, and a community reeling from loss, but still ticking along as communities do. You don't have to be a Shakespearean scholar to love this book. You really just need to believe in hope and have an interest in seeing how history repeats itself. My colleague, Emily, recommended this book to me, and I read it over 4th of July weekend at a very low, stressful time, and just could not stop thinking about it. So I wanted to pass it over to Emily and hear what she has to say about Hamnet.
Yes, thank you, Liz. I'm just going to underscore how bold a work of fiction I think this book is. To write about Shakespeare in a serious literary novel, which is what this is, takes some bravura. And there are so few sort of hard facts that we know about Shakespeare's life that it's also a real opportunity for a novelist. And Maggie O'Farrell has taken these three facts: one, the death of Shakespeare's son in 1596 at the age of 11, from what cause we do not know, the writing of Hamlet, which occurred just a few years later, and the very suggestive fact that the names Hamlet and Hamnet were used interchangeably in Elizabethan England. This is a fact that's come to light in recent scholarship. So it's just inconceivable that Shakespeare wasn't thinking about his son, recently deceased, when he wrote this play. Maggie O'Farrell has taken these facts and created an entire world around them. I will say that she has the good sense to sort of kick Shakespeare off stage for much of the book. We meet him as a love-struck teenager. He's a Latin tutor at the farmhouse where Agnes, his future wife, lives. And once they fall in love and get married, he sort of disappears. And this becomes really a book about a mother's bond with her children and her devastation at the death of one of them, which is really extraordinary. The book is just full of palpable sensual imagery. There's the tang of the leather in the father, Shakespeare's father's glove shop. He was a glover. The fragrance of the apples in the shed where Shakespeare and Agnes have their first kiss. It's just a remarkably, completely realized book. Read it.
All right. The fifth and final book on the fiction side is The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. MJ, over to you.
I am so excited to talk about this book, and I'm a little bit overwhelmed with how to begin talking about it. And I think once you read it, you'll feel similarly stumped in a good way. And I think that's just because of how dynamic The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett is. It starts off in 1968 in a small town in the South. The town is populated entirely by light-skinned Black people, and the book starts off at the core are twin sisters, Stella and Desiree. They grew up in this town, but when they're 16, they run away. Then later, Stella runs away from Desiree. So then they're all split. And it really, the novel is about what happens to them in their life. Desiree goes back to her town and kind of resides there, while Stella moves to LA and starts passing as a white woman. Then the book kind of pivots and then follows their children as they're kind of navigating the world. And I don't want to, there's a lot of plot and such a good page turner way. So I don't want to spoil anything. So I'll leave it at that. But the word that comes to my mind when I think about this book is rich. This book is so layered and dynamic and complex. And the way you have this kernel that then sprouts and starts weaving together. I know I'm mixing metaphors because that's what happens when you talk about this book. You see really how all of these people's lives, Stella, Desiree, Jude, one daughter, Kennedy, another daughter, how their lives starts really intertwining and almost feels like playing with fate in such a fantastic way. But the other richness is, I like to say that this book feels like giving someone candy to feed them vegetables, and that you get this really compelling plot. But then there's also this rich conversation about what passing is. Everyone is passing in this book in some type of way. It starts off so overt with Stella, who's passing as a white woman. But then later, you have one character, one of the daughters, is an actress, a literal type of passing, professional passing. Another character, she is dating someone who is trans, and that's another type of passing as well. And then the book starts this conversation of what does it mean to pass? Who passes and why? Who is harmed and who is safe when you are passing? And in a year like 2020, when we're all thinking about our identities and all thinking about what it means to be safe, having a book this compelling and this rich, talking about these topics that we're feeling on a daily basis, It feels like a gift. And the one other thing, the last thing I'll say is this book focuses on twin sisters. I am a twin myself, and it is, as someone who's seen a lot of movies about twins, TV shows about twins, books about twins, it's really hard to get right. And Britt Bennett totally does. She gets the together and apartness of being a twin, and it doesn't feel cheesy at all. It kind of feels like two sides of the same coin. She strikes that nail right on the head, and it is such a remarkable book. But I know my colleague Lauren had a lot to say and loved this book too, so I want to pass it over to her.
Thanks, MJ. What you just said is a perfect transition to what I was thinking, which is that this book is so incredibly authentic, especially for a book that's about passing. The kind of overarching message that I really got was she's complicating, deepening the notion of passing that maybe we read in Nella Larson's book, or, you know, that we've read Toni Morrison, you know, big influences on Britt Bennett. But one of the ways that she makes the story so much even more universal and so relatable and really hammers home the emotion of it is through this story of motherhood. You know, these are two, Jude and Kennedy, the two daughters. One is white, and because of their fathers, one is effectively appears white, and one effectively appears, I mean, the way Britt Bennett describes her is blue-black. You know, it just, you know, some people do not get to pass. You know, she is, there's no denying her race. And there's just it's such a beautiful, literal, effective description of, you know, what daughters inherit or what children inherit from their parents, and how that can be positives and negatives, how it can be insecurities, how it can be choices that weren't really the daughters to make. And they're really the ones, I think, that, again, without giving away the plot, I think a lot of action lies with them. And speaking of the action, I mean, the plot is so elaborate, as MJ alluded to. And there's this moment in the book, it's probably a third of the way through, where I think you start to see the architecture of it. You're like, okay, so we have these four women, and I kind of braced myself, like, oh my God, is this what she's trying to do? Like, this is such an ambitious goal to set for yourself. And she just carries you through. I mean, there's the melodrama, there's just the incredibly, again, authentic emotion that, you know, it's not just, she doesn't just pull it off. It's really, it's a pleasure. So yeah, again, this is definitely one of my favorite books of the year.
This podcast is supported by the Shalom Hartman Institute. For decades, the Shalom Hartman Institute has been the preeminent destination for Jewish ideas and learning. The weekly Identity Crisis podcast with host Yehuda Kurtzer creates better conversations around issues facing contemporary Jewish life. For Heaven's Sake, the award-winning number one Judaism podcast with Daniil Hartman and Yossi Klein Halevi features thoughtful discussions on political and social trends in Israel and Israel-diaspora relations. Discover these chart-topping podcasts at shalomhartman.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
All right, we are going to start on the nonfiction side. First up, Hidden Valley Road by Robert Kolker. Deputy editor of the Book Review, Tina Jordan, joins us to talk about it.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Actually, listening to my colleagues talk about fiction, I'm struck at how many of the novels have a lot to do with mothers, and this nonfiction book does as well. It's the story of the Galvin family. There was Don, who is an Air Force Academy official, his wife, Mimi, and their 12 kids, 10 boys, 2 girls, born between 1945 and 1965. They were sort of a picture-perfect step-and-stairs family. They went to church every Sunday. The boys all served as altar boys. They sat down for dinner at 6 o'clock sharp every night. Their mother sent these beautiful Christmas card photos every year with the kids, you know, dressed in the matching suits and dresses. She ran a very tight ship. She sort of had to. The father, Don, was a lot less involved. He tended to call his sons by their numbers, as in, hey, number 6 over here. But that beautiful image started to crack when the oldest son, the handsome, athletic, outgoing oldest son, Donald, was in college. And he showed up at the university infirmary several times with cat bites. And the last time he was there, the staff figured out that he had these cat bites because, in fact, he was hurting animals. He was torturing these cats. And they ordered a mental health workup. And he was eventually diagnosed with schizophrenia. And then, in fairly short order, 5 brothers followed and were also diagnosed. And so what Kolker is doing in Hidden Valley Road, he's telling, on the one hand, the story of the family, but he's also telling the story of the science behind schizophrenia, the doctor's ideas of even what it was at the time the children were diagnosed, what caused it, how the treatments evolved. In fact, the Galvins became the largest single-family schizophrenia study the National Institute of Mental Health had ever had. When the boys started being diagnosed, doctors still believed that schizophrenia was caused by childhood trauma, specifically the mother. That changed over time. I think I would have to say that what sets this apart as a work of narrative journalism is Kolker's empathy, because everybody in the family, the parents, the children who are diagnosed with schizophrenia, the children who are not, but who are, of course, constantly worried that they will be, everyone really gets a fair hearing and emerges as a whole person. And there's a point in the book in which Kolker says, when one family member is diagnosed with a mental illness, the foundation of that family begins to slip, to tilt towards the sick person. And that's where everybody's energy goes. But when six family members are, that's the stuff of Greek tragedy. And it's what Kolker is exploring here. I know my colleague Lauren Christensen liked this book as much as I did. Lauren?
Yeah, I think what you're talking about, the empathy, I mean, the paranoia in this book is truly contagious. You know, as one after another child in this family starts to fall ill with this incredibly mysterious disease. And what's so interesting about it is the symptoms are totally different child to child. Even in these kids with relatively similar DNA, you know, it can look really different at different times, different manifestations. So all the other kids, you know, imagine being one of the other six children. First of all, being one of the kids who was often victimized by their sick siblings. So having to deal with that, as well as having to constantly live with the fear that you're going to be next. You know, I mean, they're all, you know, one of them is sad one day. One of them is experimenting with LSD because it's the 60s. And all of a sudden, all of these things in their lives become potential warning signs. And that mood of paranoia is so powerful in this book. And that's really just the intimate, private aspect of the story. And Tina talked about how this is also a larger cultural narrative, you know, over 20 years in the middle of the 20th century, you know, how the science behind schizophrenia really evolved. And that's a huge, huge portion of it. I'm also really interested in the shifting cultural attitudes towards mental illness broadly in the middle of the century. You know, as Tina mentioned, they were blaming schizophrenia on failures of mothering in the beginning, and the way that really shifts, and how this one family just becomes this kind of microcosm for a whole society looking at, I guess, the interplay between nature and nurture. But yeah, this is a really, really powerful book.
Lauren, thank you. All right, the second book on the nonfiction side is A Promised Land by Barack Obama. Call?
So this is a memoir by someone who all of our readers, all of our audience watching this will be very familiar with who he is, the 44th president of the United States. It's 700 pages, and apparently it's only volume one. Just to give you a sense of the book, it begins with his early life, and then it quite sort of economically takes us up towards his early political career. And then around page 200, we enter the White House. And from there, it's sort of the, you know, the wild ride of his first term. We get him emerging out of the 2008 financial crisis, passing the Affordable Care Act, that sort of strange beer summit that some people might remember, and all the way through the Arab Spring. And then the book finally ends in 2011 as he's meeting with the Marines who were involved in the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. And presumably the next volume will take us up through the second term. So what I think really distinguished this book, not just as a presidential memoir, but really just as a book, was Obama's level of introspection, his insight into himself, his way of describing his own motives, his own thinking, the way the wheels of his mind work. And I know that, you know, I think some people found this sort of maddening in Obama as a leader sometimes, this sort of penchant for constant deliberation and sort of that professorial quality that he sometimes had. But here, I think it actually makes for really great storytelling and memoir writing, because this is not just like a triumphal story of win after win after win, which, you know, one can imagine a presidential biography being. He's constantly giving you multiple sides to an argument, taking you through the process of his own decision making, you know, offering to explain where things might have gone wrong, where he could have done something different. And it really is just this sort of intimate portrait of an intelligent, thoughtful human being who happens to be sitting in the most powerful office in the world. And then on top of that, this is the first Black president. And so this insight, this perspective is particularly poignant. And there were so many moments that I found just moving, just, you know, being able to kind of look on the other side of what was happening inside the White House. There's one vignette that I still stays with me. And I just to give you like a sense of some of the quality of the book, he's describing their early weeks in the White House and the way that the two oldest, most senior butlers in the White House were Black men who had served in the White House since, I think, one Nixon, the other one Reagan. And they kept wearing, as they always did for every president, their tuxedos when they would serve them dinner. And this bothered Barack and Michelle at some point because they can kind of relate to these men. They understood them as people who could potentially be family members, and they pleaded with them to take off the tuxedos, to just wear just casual clothes when they served them. And they refused and refused and refused. And finally, he describes a conversation in which they say to these two men, say to them, you know, we don't want you to be treated differently than any other president was treated. That's important to us. That matters to us. So it's those sorts of details that really sort of elevated the book for me. And then just a word also about the writing, which I think also really for all of us was significant about this book. He really has this gift for narrative detail, which is something that we already saw in Dreams of My Father, his first book. And it comes through very strongly here, especially in the first third of the book. You know, there were details that I still remember. You know, he describes, I remember him talking about wrapping a towel around his waist while he's reading in the back of his grandfather's car after coming back from the beach in Hawaii so as not to get the seat wet. Or these very distinct memories of his daughters as babies. They're so specific and human. Obviously, this sort of rich narrative detail gets a little harder as he enters the White House and his world shrinks and it's meeting after meeting. But really, there's not a page that goes by where he doesn't try to sort of bring in something that makes the scene pop. He understands what he needs to do to sort of put you there. So ultimately, this felt like we were just given, a very special insight by a man who knows himself well and is willing to be honest and has the skills to also write a page turner, even at 700 pages. I know Liz, my colleague, my esteemed colleague, also appreciated this book. So can you tell us a little bit more?
I definitely did appreciate it. Thank you, Gal. I haven't spent this much time in a former president's head, I think, since I did a report in third or fourth grade on Warren G. Harding. And it was really a pleasure to be in President Obama's head for 701 pages, I think. And what really spoke to me about this book, aside from the fascinating window into working with other world leaders and to the, you know, the front row seat on the machinations of the US government, what really hit me as I read it was this incredibly intimate look at the Obama family. There's a generosity to President Obama's storytelling that I don't think I've seen before, especially in the Harding paperwork that I read back in the day. But we really come to understand what this family, this very ordinary family, what they sacrificed for the time they were living in the White House, not being able to run to CBS, not being able to just walk the dog down the street. And we really get inside President Obama's head and also inside Michelle's head. I, of course, have also read her memoir. And I would say this one gave me an even deeper insight into how hard the first year of the administration was on her. And I appreciated not only the sacrifice, but the generosity of being able to wrap my mind around that. I always thought of presidents as people who were somehow other, who weren't part of my world in any way. But reading this book, you really understand how the Obamas were an ordinary family who made a tremendous sacrifice for our country. So don't be daunted by the length of this book. It goes quickly, and it's also a great book to pass to teenagers, if you have any who are interested in the way the world works and the way the government runs. It's not just for an adult audience.
Liz, thank you. I want to just inject one note here, a little bit of how the sausage is made with regard to that book, because as I said, this is a year-long process, but this book just came out. And so whereas we had months to deliberate about most of the other books on our list, this one, basically, we had a weekend. And to get to the point that both Gal and Liz made about the readability of the book, it really read very quickly, which was useful for us because we were all essentially reading it in 2 days. And then we convened on a Monday to have a very, you know, real conversation about, let's make sure that we are judging this book as a memoir and trying to separate that from what a memoir, a presidential memoir, means at this moment and sort of the grand statement and politics behind that book, and to really look at the book as a work of writing in and of itself. The next book, also a book about writing in its way, is Shakespeare in a Divided America by James Shapiro. And to talk about that, senior editor Greg Coles.
Thank you, Pamela. More than any other book, I think, on our list, this one tells you right in its title what it's about. It's a book about Shakespeare in a divided America. If you know anything about the author, James Shapiro, you know how qualified he is to write this book. He's a Shakespeare scholar, a professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University, who's written a number of other books about Shakespeare, including in 2014, he edited a volume for the Library of America called Shakespeare in America that compiled reviews of Shakespeare productions over the years, speeches that people had written influenced by Shakespeare, or other plays that drew on Shakespeare. So kind of looking at the reception of Shakespeare in America. And this book seems like a clear follow-up to that. Instead of Shakespeare in America, it's Shakespeare in a Divided America. And he starts in colonial times and moves generation by generation and issue by issue through big conflicts defining American society, looking at how those played out very specifically in productions of Shakespeare. So he starts out talking about miscegenation and racism in America, talking about how John Quincy Adams responded very violently against Desdemona's desire for Othello in Othello. It's not even that John Quincy Adams hated Othello or was racist. It's more that he hated the mixing of the races. And instead of responding against Othello, he responded against Desdemona and her desire. So he gets into these kind of nuanced things like that. Then he moves on to Manifest Destiny. And what's interesting there is he's talking about America's sense of itself as it's kind of taking on its brashness and moving across the continent. He looks at a production of Romeo and Juliet where Romeo was played by an actress, Charlotte Cushman, who was lesbian, although they didn't have the term for it then, and often took male roles in Shakespeare and was renowned for her Romeo and traveled Europe to great success, but just at a time that America was kind of seizing new land. And she came to represent this brash American identity for her portrayals of Romeo. And he moves on then. Marriage is one, and he talks about Taming the Shrew, and immigration is one, and he talks about The Tempest and specifically about Caliban in The Tempest and so on, right up to the present. He has a little detour, not into a Shakespeare play itself, but into the movie Shakespeare in Love. And he talks about the early script for Shakespeare in Love that had a lot of gender bending and same-sex stuff going on, and how that was not okay with Hollywood back in the 90s, and how they trimmed all of that out. And then he brings it right up to the Shakespeare in the Park production of Julius Caesar in 2017 that became a huge cultural touchstone because Caesar was portrayed by a Donald Trump lookalike. So his assassination, the right-wing media seized on it, saying, look at these liberal New Yorkers advocating for the assassination of the president. And Shapiro points out that, in fact, back in 2012, in Obama's administration, somebody had staged Julius Caesar with an Obama lookalike, and there was no parallel outcry on the left. So what he's doing, I read this book right before I read Hamnet, and knowingly, I read it kind of as preparation for reading Hamnet, to get in the mindset to read about Shakespeare's life in a work of fiction. And I was expecting to read a work of literary criticism, that this is what James Shapiro does. And it's not that, really. It's a work of history and of cultural history that very nimbly shows how these issues recur and intersect with each other, racism and sexism and class war. Maybe my favorite chapter in this whole book was about an incident I was not familiar with before I read it, the Astor Place riots in 1849, where you have, again, a brash American actor, Edwin Forrest, who is in kind of direct competition with a slightly foppish British actor, I think it's William Charles MacReady, where they're staging competing versions of the same plays in New York City and kind of going head to head with their different acting styles. And it came to symbolize this class war of the elites, the foppish British sympathizers against the American kind of direct, manly, macho portrayal. And it resulted finally in a riot of tens of thousands of people in Astor Place, where the militia came in. There were like 20 deaths, cobblestones thrown through the Astor Place Opera House, the theater where MacReady was staging Macbeth. And so you get this sense that these things that we're still dealing with today, we have always been dealing with. It was popular during the Trump era for historians to remind Americans that this extreme partisanship that we're facing is nothing new in American life, in American culture. It has always been with us. And this is a book that does that a little bit in that kind of John Meacham sense of, I think, trying to reassure you that, no, we've been through this before. I personally didn't find it reassuring. I found it terrifying that we live on the brink and have lived on the brink since the beginning. But I love how Shapiro turns it, takes you through this all through the lens of Shakespeare. It shows that the plays are still alive and depend entirely on what the audience brings to them with your cultural worldview and your cultural context. And you draw out different meaning from it depending on where you're coming to it. I know Emily liked this book as well. I'd like to give her a chance.
Well, Greg, you've covered it so comprehensively. I'll just add one or two points. One, you would think that just about everything that can be said about Shakespeare has been said. And we have two books, one a work of fiction and then this cultural history about Shakespeare. And yet this book is just filled with amazing factoids and insights. I'll just highlight a few. One, it's very striking. Shapiro gives abundant evidence that Americans seem to have been, over the course of our history, more engaged with Shakespeare's work than any other people on earth, including Britain. From John Quincy Adams to the Trump era, we have invoked Shakespeare in our political discourse in particular in very striking ways. We have 150 summer Shakespeare festivals. That dwarfs anyone else anywhere in the world. We really love this guy. So the book is just populated with fresh and surprising insights. And Shapiro is constantly stressing how malleable Shakespeare's works are. They are so subtle and complex. He's irreducible to a political or ideological position and has therefore been embraced by people like Stephen Bannon on the one hand and people on the left on the other. And this is a taut book. It's a supple, elegant book. It goes down like a tall, fresh drink. It's really fun.
Thanks, Emily. All right. The fourth book on the nonfiction side is Uncanny Valley by Anna Wiener. Lauren, over to you.
Thank you. At this point, it feels really impossible that this book came out in 2020. I think it was like the beginning of January, which is just, it's hard to only stretch back in my memory. But this book, so Anna Wiener right now is a New Yorker writer, 30-something, and she writes about tech in San Francisco. So, you know, if that could be a bit of a tip-off for the general thrust of the book. But, she's looking back on a time when she was in her mid-20s, it's mid-2010s, and she was working at a low-paying publishing job in New York City and got swept up in the wave that was pulling a lot of her peers, you know, educated young people towards Silicon Valley, the allure of the six-figure salaries and the office perks with like free snacks and, you know, just the general optimism about a brighter future that I think, dare I say, I don't know, publishing may not always offer. But, you know, this memoir is really about Wiener's gradual disillusionment with that promise. You know, she becomes more and more enmeshed in the culture of digitizing everything, optimizing everything, streamlining, and, you know, the thought that everything has to be extremely efficient and everyone has to be productive all the time. And she starts to see and describes so beautifully and articulately the consequence of that, which is that our individuality as human beings are, even sometimes our morality, can be eroded if not erased in some extreme cases. My colleagues and I talked about this one scene that was particularly effective where you know, it's presumed, she never names it, but it's presumed she works for the software company GitHub. And she is walking along the streets of San Francisco and she sees a homeless man wearing a zip-up hoodie, bearing the logo of her company. And it's just this really powerful, brief image of sort of how corporate America becomes the detritus it leaves in its wake. I mean, just pivoting to the writing, it's so sharp and insightful. There's something really savage about the East Coast literary voice on the kind of tech bro culture that's very entertaining. It can be so funny at times in a very wry and sarcastic way. It's incredibly funny and cool, but it's also a broader indictment of our generation. I think, you know, you start to feel like these problems that are, I guess, identified sometimes in our culture with the Bay Area, with Silicon Valley, with tech, with the digital era, are actually everywhere. It's this global generational fear, I guess, or insecurity, anxiety that, you know, we are never efficient enough, never productive enough, you know, we're never original enough, never good enough. So I think that kind of description and exploration of where that might be coming from, I don't know, it made me feel a lot better about my anxieties. So yeah, Greg, what did you think?
You know, what I really loved about this book was her voice. There's something very game about her as she moves through these things. She's never quite sure what she wants, but she says, just bring it at me. I don't quite know what the term gimlet-eyed means, except in context. And she's a very gimlet-eyed narrator as she leads you through this. And it's a book, because of the voice, it stitches together her true memoir, but also this kind of sociological look and deep journalistic look at an industry that has been very mythologized in the past generation. And she kind of tears that down. So I was just very impressed.
Thanks, Greg. All right. The fifth book on the nonfiction side and the 10th book among our 10 best of 2020 is War, How Conflict Shaped Us by Margaret MacMillan. Dave Kim, over to you.
Margaret MacMillan begins her book with the pretty extraordinary claim that we don't take war seriously enough. This, you know, despite all of the hand-wringing in our political discussions, you know, all of the trillions that we're spending on defense and all of the books that we publish every year. But MacMillan is saying this because she wants to show us how war has shaped really every aspect of our lives and regularly changes the course of human history. So to understand where humanity is heading, you know, we need very much to study how war is evolving. This is a brisk history. We don't get this like long chronological slog through every war since the beginning of time. Instead, MacMillan takes a more subject by subject approach. She's drawing from different disciplines and sources. So, you know, we'll be talking about Greek military formations in one moment and then Picasso's Guernica in another. And you just have so many aspects of our lives, major technological advances, systems of government, medical processes, all of them owing their existence to war, whether it's preparations for them or the after effects. You know, and centralized state power comes about in large part because of the need to defend against threats. So she's doing this, and then she shows us how society has in turn shaped conflict, how warfare itself has been transformed, even as it transforms us. And as fascinating as this book is, I also found it there's something deeply disturbing about a book that so convincingly argues that war and humanity are just inextricably linked. The questions, of course, that come to mind are like, is war just part of our nature? And so are we just doomed to be fighting it all the time? And if so much of our society has been shaped by conflict, is war ultimately productive? Is it even good? MacMillan argues that these tough questions often deter scholars from doing gimlet-eyed examinations of war. They're, you know, constantly trying to spin the story toward peace and progress. And she's definitely not pro-war, but she's also not shy about showing how we've really capitalized, even benefited, and, you know, spent so much energy perfecting this thing that is so terribly destructive. And I think that's why I was taken by this book, despite how troubling it can be at times. It takes a really hard look without flinching from the uncomfortable realities of a very uncomfortable subject. And it invites us to really wrestle with these questions. I think the more that we pick at these kinds of tensions, the closer we get to understanding them. And that, to me, makes it very worthwhile. And just to be mindful of time, I guess I'll kick it back to Pamela.
All right. Those are our top 10 books of 2020. And you would get the sense, listening to all of us, that we are all in concord and agreement, and that this is not a sharp-elbowed group of people with very strong opinions. That's not the case. We all have our individual passions and preferences. And so while this process is one of consensus, everyone inevitably has a book that remains a personal favorite that they really want to call out for special attention. And so I just want to give each of the editors here a chance to talk about books very briefly that they really loved in 2020 that were not on the 10 best list. So again, quickly we'll run through them, and I'm going to start with Lauren Christensen.
One of the books that I really loved this year that did not make it onto the list is Undocumented Americans by Carla Conejo Villavicencio. This is a Harvard grad, current Yale PhD student who is undocumented herself. She migrated from Ecuador to the US when she was a kid. I think she grew up in New York. And, you know, she's just telling you in this really cool, very unpretentious, never talking down to you way about the stories of real undocumented Americans across the country. So she has a chapter where she goes to Miami, she goes to the site of the World Trade Center attacks, she goes to Flint, Michigan. Actually, that's one of the sections that I really loved. And I think she's playing with and almost critiquing the common notions of journalism, which are that you never get involved with your subjects. And I think she really goes there and she's like, I can't see the suffering of these people who cannot drink their water and have no recourse with the government without trying to get involved myself. She's a very sharp voice. And I recommend that book as well.
All right. Next up, John Williams.
I'm going to recommend a novel by a British writer named Evie Wilde. She was born in London and raised in Australia and London. Her third novel, The Bass Rock, came out this year. I was a fan of the previous ones, and so I was kind of looking forward to what she would do next, and it's been 6 years since the last one. I'll be very brief. It's a very capacious book, so it's hard to be brief. It's set in three different time periods, essentially the modern day, just after World War II, and then another section that happens in the 1700s, all in the same village on the coast of Scotland. And they all deal with women's lives and the sort of looming specter of male violence against them at all times. And it stitches these three together. That subject matter sounds very grim, but reading it is sort of the opposite of that. Wilde is a very conventionally entertaining writer in some ways. The modern day, you know, sections feel very fresh. The ancient section feels very strangely imagined and almost feral. And so she's just always got you on a string. And she's a writer who I think can do almost anything, proves it in this book. And I'm going to be watching what she does for a long time. So that's The Bass Rock by Evie Wilde.
Thanks, John. Greg Coles.
One book that really got in my head and has stayed with me this year since I read it is Just Us by the writer Claudia Rankine. Anybody familiar with her earlier book, Citizen, will recognize the shape of this book, which is kind of part poetry and part essay and photographs. It's not quite a poetry collection or an essay collection or a photograph collection. It's almost more like her notebooks or journal as she thinks about issues of race, as she did in Citizen, but where Citizen was very much thinking about questions of Blackness and what it was like, what it is like to experience Blackness in America. Just Us is a book that very much interrogates whiteness and asks white people to think about race in the same way that Black people have to all the time. She thinks that whiteness is, as the default position, it's something that we don't notice enough, and yet it impacts kind of how we move through life all the time. And so she's thinking through these issues on the page in a way that I haven't been able to let go of since I read it.
All right, Greg, thank you. Tina Jordan.
I don't know about the rest of you, but I've spent a lot of time, you know, in the last year wishing I were someplace else, which is perhaps why I loved a book so much called Owls of the Eastern Ice by a scientist named Jonathan Slott, who was looking for and tagging the largest owl in the world, the fish owl, which lives in the deep forests of Japan, China, and Russia. And he was tagging them so that they could figure out where the birds were breeding and protect those habitats. But it's not the science part that really interested me. It's the travelogue part. He's a beautiful writer. And I don't know, I felt like I was snowshoeing through the Siberian forest and walking into villages where people handed me buckets of, you know, vodka and raw moose meat. It was just a book that took me completely away from myself this year.
Tina, thanks. All right, David Kim, over to you.
My pick is Jack by Marilyn Robinson, which was a bit of a polarizing book, but one I loved a lot. This is a standalone prequel in her Gilead series. It's about an interracial romance in post-war St. Louis. And what's fascinating is how Robinson keeps the segregated world of Jim Crow at bay for a while. And she imagines a kind of strange Eden where a white man and a black woman can fall in love on their own terms and aren't weighed down by the burdens of race. That obviously doesn't last long. The world, as the book progresses, starts to assert itself more and more strongly, but they manage to keep their love alive. It's a slow burn for sure, but a life-affirming one, and I think a deep rebuttal to racial determinism and hatred.
All right, MJ Franklin.
My pick is Cleanness by Garth Greenwell. On a sentence-by-sentence basis, I don't know of a more masterly writer than Garth Greenwell. He is able to, with the string of words he puts together and the flourishes that he adds or the repetitions that he adds, it feels like he is speaking directly to my heart, my soul. I can go on for days and days about this, but I will say in this collection, there's a short story, The Frog King, which in a year that has been so heavy, The Frog King looks at what it feels like to fall in love. And it feels like an author is whispering this to you. It is so intimate. It is so tender, so beautiful. And Garth has that quality, even when he's writing about something that's brutal too, as some of the later stories, it feels like a collection that has been written and told directly to you with so much heart and soul. And just the craft of it on a sentence basis is tremendous. So my pick is The Cleanest by Garth Greenwell.
All right, Liz Egan.
My pick is The Death of Vivek Oggi by Akweke Emezie. I would describe it as a poetic mystery. It begins when a mother in a small town in Nigeria opens her front door and finds the body of her young adult son on the doorstep. And the book is about how Vivek died, but it is also about whether or not his family and his community and his loved ones ever really knew him.
Thank you. Emily Aiken.
My pick is Hurricane Season by Fernanda Melchor. This is the first novel to appear in English by Melchor, who is a young Mexican writer. And this book is not for the faint of heart. It is strong stuff. It reads like a punch in the face, but I deeply admire the way Melchor found a form for a story that is unusually violent. The book is an electric read. It has the trappings of a fairy tale. It opens on the discovery of a dead body. A local person known as the witch in this little village has been murdered. And the book proceeds to describe chapter by chapter different characters who have entanglements with the witch. And the book is saturated with violence and brutality, a misogyny that is both verbal and physical. And Melchor captures this in chapters that are written in a single paragraph, practically a single sentence, as if in one furious breath. She's spoken of the book as an allegory for the epidemic of violent murders of women in Mexico. The country is awash in femicide. And she captures this culture of violence with an originality that is striking and at times improbably beautiful.
All right. Gall Beckerman really wanted to talk about two books, so I'm passing on mine and I give mine over to Gall.
Thank you, Pamela. So I'll do this very quickly. And I think both these books cover categories that may not have been covered in the 10 best. So I really wanted to do them. One is Eat the Buddha by Barbara Demick. Demick is a journalist, and she tells the story of this small town in the Sichuan province of eastern China that has a Tibetan population and has become the center of resistance to Chinese authority. And more specifically, over about the past 10 years, has become what she calls in the book the undisputed world capital of self-immolations. This has been a tactic of resistance. There's been 156 self-immolations over that 10 years, and a third of them are from this small little town. So she just tells this sort of panoramic story of the town going over back about 4 or 5 decades, and through a number of different characters, she has this way of sort of having this multivocal approach that she takes, where you're just following a bunch of different people, and it's just wonderfully, wonderfully reported piece of journalism. The other book is a very different kind of book. It's The Weirdest People in the World by Joseph Henrich. Henrich is at Harvard. He's the chair of the Human Evolutionary Biology Department. And this is this great, big, ambitious argument book in which he's trying to make a case that there is a distinctiveness to Western psychology. And he is bringing to bear, and this book is, I think it's even longer than the Obama book. It's, you know, maybe 800 pages, bringing to bear all of these different studies in order to make this argument. And it swings back and forth between history and psychology and economics. And if you like a book that sort of goes for trying to do a theory of everything, this one might be for you.
Thank you, Paul. All right. Listening to everyone here, you probably get a sense of why I am so grateful to have this incredible team of editors working together with me here at the New York Times Book Review. I want to recap the 10 best books of 2020. Here they are once again. On the fiction side, A Children's Bible by Lydia Millett, Deacon King Kong by James McBride, Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell, Homeland Elegies by Ead Akhtar, The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett, and in nonfiction, Hidden Valley Road by Robert Colker, A Promised Land by Barack Obama, Shakespeare in a Divided America by James Shapiro, Uncanny Valley by Anna Wiener, and War, How Conflict Shaped Us by Margaret Macmillan. Congratulations to all of those books, and a thank you to everyone for sitting patiently as we went through them, as well as our favorites.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.